You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, Latin American nations vote. Uruguay heads to a runoff ballot, while in the past few weeks, Brazil and Bolivia have decided to keep their incumbents. Journalist Isabel Hilton and Latin American specialist Oscar Guardiola Rivera will tell us what these results mean and where the continent is shifting. Then from one presidential palace to another, from Bolivia's proposed new palace, we go to Turkey, where our bureau chief, Joseph Dana, takes us through the house President Erdogan built.
We are talking about a complex beyond imagination for a political leader in this part of the world. It costs something like $350 million. It has 1,000 rooms, an underground tunnel system.
But no moat. Then we learn about a civics class in Pakistan where Western philosophy is on the syllabus.
A lot of people see this as just a way to read books and talk about, you know, government and democracy, which is such a big thing in Pakistan these days.
All that ahead, plus our arts reviewer is in to talk about why there's been a decline in British buyers of contemporary art. That's all coming up right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy then in the next 60 minutes here on the programme. Before we start though, let's get the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Paul Osborne. The African Union has given the military in Burkina Faso 2 weeks to hand power to a civilian transitional government. The military stepped in after the country's long-serving president, Blaise Compaoré, was forced from office after violent protests last week. Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Sida, who is leading the current government, has promised to hand power to civilians. But Monocle's West Africa correspondent, Alex Duval-Smith, says that could be a lengthy process.
It's going to come down to the level at which the military can be trusted to oversee a transition, it seems, because there are elements within the Burkinabe army, if you remove the presidential guard from the equation, that are seen as being progressive. And in fact, the Burkina Faso's army, there are elements of it that are considered extremely professional.
Officials in Pakistan say they reinstated a ceremony at the border crossing with India to show the country was united against terrorism. It had been cancelled after a suicide attack on Sunday killed 55 people. That's been blamed by India on extremists who it says are tacitly supported inside Pakistan. In Islamabad, Shia Muslims have marked Ashura, one of the most important dates in their calendar, amid tight security. Asmatullah Junejo is from the city's police.
We have just carried out a complete sweeping of the area by the bomb disposal squad. As far as the entry of suicide bomber is concerned, you can just see we have maintained strict vigilance on all the entry points. All the rooftops are covered.
At least 23 people are now known to have died in a suicide bomb attack in northeastern Nigeria. Militants targeted a procession of Shia Muslims in Yobe State, the territory at the heart of the Boko Haram insurgency. The group has taken control of the town of Mubi, prompting thousands of people to flee. Ibrahim Hamidou from the Nigerian Red Cross says there is nowhere for the refugees to go.
The camp is now fully occupied. We don't have place that will keep this thing. We don't have room. The numbers of men we have 3,472. The number for females is 4,190.
A boat carrying migrants has sunk in the sea off Turkey's northern coast, killing at least 24 people. It happened close to Istanbul. A number of children are among those on board, and several people are still missing. It's thought the migrants were escaping the civil war in Syria, trying to get inside the European Union. Malaysia has said it wants to turn the wreckage of the passenger jet that crashed in eastern Ukraine into a memorial to the disaster's victims. 298 people died when flight MH17 came down in July. It's thought to have been hit by a surface-to-air missile. Russia says that rebels in eastern Ukraine now have a mandate for formal talks with the government in Kiev after the weekend's elections. But Ukraine's rulers continue to dismiss the vote in Luhansk and Donetsk as a farce. Pro-Russian separatists have named a leader of their breakaway republic after those elections. Meanwhile, NATO's supreme allied commander in Europe has warned Russia's stepped-up incursions of European airspace. General Philip Breedlove says it's making the situation in Europe less stable.
Across history, most of these incursions have been very small groups of airplanes, sometimes singletons or at most two aircraft. And what you saw this past week was a larger, more complex formation of aircraft carrying out a little deeper and I would say a little bit more provocative flight path. And so it is a concern.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 14.06 in New York City. Joining me here in Studio One at Midori House are both the journalist Isabel Hilton, who's the editor of China Dialogue, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, lecturer in law at Birkbeck University of London. Welcome both to the programme. Uruguay, the latest South American country to hold elections. The party in power, Broad Front, and their leader Tabaré Vázquez has won the first round of voting, but their failure to secure a majority means the vote will go to a final runoff later on this month. Lots of interesting issues. Oscar, I'll start with you, that have been informing this campaign in particular, the commercialization of cannabis amongst them. I just wonder what you make in broad terms about what seems likely, the return probably of Tabaré Vázquez. Is this sort of going back in time for this country a little bit?
I think so, a little bit. Although it has to be said that the legacy of Pepe Mujica is going to be, you know, so important, is going to be so huge that Tabaré will have to work hard to appear at least as progressive and as forward-looking as his predecessor. Legacy of Mujica left the Frente Amplio with wonderful possibilities, with also challenging tasks, particularly, as you mentioned, the consequences of the legalization of marijuana, but also the repositioning of the country in economic terms vis-a-vis its two main neighbors, Argentina, who's most likely in some trouble, and Brazil, which still, although the economy has decelerated, seems to be moving forward.
Isabel, what do you make then of this sort of campaign? Broad Front, Tabaré Vázquez look likely to succeed. What do you think will be the key, I guess, issues on the agenda in broad terms, I guess, for the country?
Well, I think in general terms, I think Latin America is facing a slowdown overall. It's a end to the commodities boom, or at least the commodities boom is slowing down. I find the marijuana aspect interesting because there's a broader issue of drugs in Latin America, of course, cocaine, cartels and all that. And there has long been a feeling in Latin America that legalization might be a way out of the criminal conspiracy that is funded through the drugs trade. So I think this is an interesting experiment. It's one that I can't imagine having flourished even 20 years ago. So I think it's one to watch. And I think it might, help to open up the discussion on drugs, which we're already beginning to see, it emerged here recently and then was squashed again. But you can see, at least the beginnings of a broad coalition on an end to the rather negative results of the war on drugs, and perhaps the beginning of a more enlightened policy.
That would be news indeed. Oscar, do you think it is an issue of right and left when it comes to drugs policy in the region? Because, I mean, some people say, but I guess maybe people slightly on the right of the spectrum, well, look, this would actually be very damaging for our reputation internationally. That's not really a part of this, is it?
Not really. I mean, this repositioning on the war of drugs cuts across the usual politics. There are left-wing leaders such as Pepe Mujica who have moved forward, but you would also remember that President Santos of Colombia and former President Gaviria, nobody would accuse of being any bit to the right of the center, to the left of the center, have also affirmed the necessity of rethinking the war on drugs. There is widespread consensus even within the United States, although of course the internal politics there does not always allow politicians to say what they think. But the latest figures show that 52% of Americans would support the legalization of marijuana, or at least a rethink of this failed policy. South of the border, if we see what is happening now in Mexico, well, this is more important than ever. So the fact that the entire continent is coming together behind this new, more progressive attitude is most welcome.
Let's take a little bit of a step back, because whilst we have to wait until the end of the month to find out the results of Uruguay's elections decisively, we do know who's in charge in Brazil, in Bolivia also. Some commentators were sort of suggested that the so-called sort of pink tide was going to retreat, but it seems these leftist politicians like Dilma Rousseff, Evo Morales appear to be very much staying in power. Isabel, let me ask you then about that sort of pink tide brand. Is that alive and well? Is that even a useful label anymore?
Well, I'm not sure that it's one thing. I don't think Dilma Rousseff would appreciate being bracketed, even with the mood in Argentina, let alone Venezuela or Ecuador, all of which could sort of qualify as a kind of pink tide. So you get a lot of variation between them. You know, the Andean countries have one style, if you like. Venezuela seems to be heading off the cliff, despite having one of the largest oil reserves in the world. Argentina is again, mired in endless problems over its financial relations, and has been actually for 40 years, but specifically since the great collapse in 2001. So, I'm not sure that either the individual politicians would necessarily associate themselves with each other, or that if you looked at the policy and the economic outcome of their policy, you would find all that much in common. So in Bolivia, you have essentially you have a terrific commodities boom and the economy is doing extremely well. And why not re-elect, the man who has at least done something towards distributing that? So they have gas and they have minerals, and that has been extremely resilient. Ecuador is looking to do deals with China on oil in particular. And the kind of wild card in all this, which has enabled at least some leftist policies to flourish, is of course the fact that China has driven economic growth in Latin America certainly for the last decade and a little longer. And that has relieved the entire continent from the kind of pressure that the United States used to exercise when this was definitively the US backyard. So the long history of overthrowing left-wing governments or undermining them economically, That era is really over. And so you can have a much greater diversity of policy, I think, in Latin America these days, which rests on the fact that there is another big economic player in the region.
Extremely interesting, Oscar. Would you go along with that? I mean, is it, if we're then looking at sort of broad geopolitical trends, it's actually more interesting to look very, very much outside the borders of Latin America altogether to the likes of China, as Isabel says, to see where the real things that are shaping what's happening are coming from?
I think Isabel is absolutely right on that point. In fact, I've been talking since 2012, since What If Latin America Ruled the World, about the fact that we are witnessing the emergence of a more effective south-to-south alliance. So it is China, it is India, it is also South Africa. And this is not only rhetoric, but now We see, clear trade deals, as Isabel mentioned. In countries, for the majority of countries of Latin America, China has become the second, if not the first, most important economic partner. But there is also political backstory to that. There is a certain back history of standing up to the interventionism of the usual suspects. And on that respect, I may have to vary a little bit with something that Isabel said. Yes, indeed, there is no monolithic left in Latin America. There has never been a monolithic left in Latin America, but actually tremendous creativity in terms of progressivism. But it is not the case that, we see countries such as Venezuela falling off the cliff. If anything, of course, there is no denying that there are strong economic problems there. But we must also change the terms of the conversation and analysis when speaking of Latin America, because this is not the case of electorates and social movements backing governments on the basis of their economic performance. If that had been the case, most probably Dilma would have lost the election. Actually, there is something more. There is real politics here. There is a real difference between the candidate on the left and the candidate on the right. Yes, they're not the same. You cannot compare Venezuela with Brazil. You cannot compare Ecuador with Bolivia. But there are also common terms. And the common denominator is a desire, a clear desire to speak as an equal, as a mature society. Latin Americans for far too long have been treated as if they were the backyard of the United States. They no longer are. They are deciding on their own terms. And this is what is making the continent so interesting politically, economically. Again, there are no silver bullet solutions or proofs, but things are moving on in a very interesting direction, so much so that even Southern Europe is beginning to import some of these models. Consider Podemos in Spain.
Mm. It's interesting though, that if that shift is happening, Isabel, that we are still seeing some of these, old faces. I mean, I asked that to Oscar at the beginning. Tabaré Vázquez, a former president, of course. Evo Morales, a third term. There's whispers that we could see Lula, in 2018, aged in his, I guess, mid 70s. Do you think is it problematic to have a lack of refreshed political characters if the politics itself is changing?
Well, the politics, I mean, I think all of those people have come to prominence in an era in which, there have been greater possibilities. And they've all argued the redistribution case. I mean, one of the great problems and continuing problems of Latin America is fantastic inequalities in wealth. And all of the people you mentioned actually have a redistributive agenda, even if Brazil's is not been quite as, I think Dilma has not got any particular credit for it. Think of the demonstrations in São Paulo, and maybe that was why her majority was thinner. I think there are a couple of things to watch, though. One, the degree to which the terms of trade are building up problems in the future. Is this still growth without development? Is it, if you like, a neocolonial kind of commodities pattern of trade? And are those revenues being spent on buying votes through welfareism, or are they being spent on the kind of investment in a more sustainable economy? And I think those are the questions that certainly hang over Venezuela, where you have a lot of welfareism, where you have the kind of politics in which the president, the incumbent, will change the constitution to allow him a third term of office. We see a lot of that. Are we building up a kind of caudillismo, a populist caudillismo that depends on high commodity revenues and which will eventually lead to a bust? I think those are still questions about the direction that Latin America is taking.
Oscar, when we sort of talk about Latin America in this holistic way, is that fundamentally unhelpful? Just to sort of, you get different people make observations about divides even within countries. We saw them quite profoundly in Brazil between regions during the election and post. What about the divisions then in terms of the Latin American land mass more broadly? People say, oh, there's a division between the Atlantic and the Pacific, for example, and that's economic as well as, of course, geographical. What do you think there are key divisions that maybe sometimes in the Western media, parts of the Western media, we miss altogether?
Well, the very name Latin America was imposed upon Latin Americans from without. So, you know, from the very outset, you encounter those problems. Just as there is no monolithic left, there is no Latin America as a monolith. But there are, as the Colombian novelist García Márquez used to say, there are fundamental similarities, common problems more than anything, common challenges. And I think you put it very well, Isabel, when you mentioned the need for Latin American governments of the center-left, to reinvent their case. It's no longer just a matter of redistribution. It is also a matter of building the kind of infrastructure that would allow these kind of politics, to survive and not to get bust on the basis of, inflation and so on and so forth, and ill-thought welfareism. There is a need to reinvent welfare. There is a need to change the terms of the conversation from the language of the 1980s and 1990s as well. That is to say, this is not just the case that you see in Uruguay, you know, the opposition candidate speaking of in terms of a smaller state and so on and so forth. That language in Latin America sounds incredibly dated. I mean, I know that sometimes, you know, here in Europe, we think that is still where politics lies. That is not the case in Latin America. But I would say that, and this is also an answer to your previous question, that the first tide of the pink tide may have exhausted its resources, and it needs to reinvent itself if it wants to continue leading the continent. There is, to answer your latest question, a desire for a proper Latin American process of unification, a desire that has become more concrete. It is allowing the continent to speak with one language, both to the U.S., but also to multinational corporations and so on. And that is helpful in any, you know, in any sense of the term. It is a demonstration of maturity. But of course, as you mature, you need to change. You need to endeavor to do your best.
Isabel, on that point, we see a lot of these sort of LATAM institutions that seem to be very effective. There's so many of them. It's like an acronym soup. You can't almost get to grips with it. Do you think, also, when we look in terms of foreign policy terms, we talked a little bit about economic relationships with other countries around the world, China in particular, which you discussed. Do you think it will take better institutions, or a single institution, a unifying institution, as Oscar describes there, to give voice to that kind of collective? Will that be what shapes foreign policy for most of these countries?
I think if you look at the difficulties that the European Union has with devising a common foreign policy, this after, 50 years of ever closer union, I wouldn't entirely hold my breath on the foreign policy aspect. But I do think that Latin America would greatly benefit from some of these institutions becoming deeper. You know, we have a lot of them. But institutions like Mercosur, which is, you know, probably the oldest, been around a long time, it could still do with institution building. And I think institution building is a huge thing. I mean, I agree that shrinking the state in Latin America sounds a bit, there's plenty for the state to do. And one of the things that the states ought to do is better governance and better institutions. I'm not sure we're entirely moving in that direction. I mean, one of the worrying trends in a number of these countries are things like attacks on the independent press, for instance, in Argentina, in Venezuela, press that represent positions or sectors that the government doesn't like. But I don't think any of these countries are so well governed that you can afford to do without, you know, independent criticism. I think that the tendency towards authoritarianism is always something that you have to keep in mind.
In fact, Tom, on that respect, it is very interesting to see how it is in those countries that most people would not identify with the pink tide, particularly Mexico, where you see terrible problems of the kind that Isabel has just described. On the one hand, attacks on the press or a domination of the press, a reemergence of what Mexicans call the perfect dictatorship of the PRI, the party in government, and extreme violence of the kind that you can no longer attribute solely to criminals, but rather to this melange, this intertwinement between, unbridled accumulation in all aspects of life, and politics and criminality. So yes, there is a need to contain authoritarian attitudes, but not just in the countries that are more often than not put on the spot by the press, Venezuela and so on and so forth, but also in places like Mexico. And I think it is very interesting the fact that it is Mexico, but also Colombia, again, the non-really leftist countries, the ones that are seeing the most trouble. This is not to say, of course, that there isn't trouble elsewhere.
Those are the insights of Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Isabel Hilton is with us as well here on Midori House. When we return in just a moment, we'll take a closer look at why Argentina's government is having a bit of a set-to with Procter & Gamble. Stay tuned.
On the 9th of November, Berlin will mark 25 years since the fall of the wall that divided it for over half a century.
I think we were the only one who realized that it's happening. People didn't realize. Everybody was excited. And it was a couple of times that night I was really not scared, but it could have ended completely different,
In a series of special reports, Monocle 24 assesses the state of Germany today from its shifting political landscape.
Germany politically is developing in a direction which we cannot agree with. We have to do something because this cannot go on.
To its music, its faith, and its sporting arenas.
If there are winners and losers in such reunion, I think the sport lost.
That's The Fall of the Wall, a series of special reports all this week on The Globalist from 6 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24.
It's 26 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm with Isabel Hilton and Oscar Guardiola Rivera here in Studio One. What's going on in Argentina? I've got written on my script next. The government's taken a curious step when it comes to dealing with the world's number one household product maker. It suspended Procter & Gamble from doing business in the country. It's unclear exactly what suspended means, but in a statement, the government is accusing the company of overbilling in imports to get money out of the country. Meanwhile, last week, President Kirchner posted a letter on a social media site telling Barack Obama there'd be grave implications amid claims a US official is lobbying for a group representing the so-called vulture funds. Oscar, this is all rather a mess, isn't it? Can you unpick the various strands of it for us?
The question what's happening in Argentina is in everybody's minds. I'm not sure anybody has the proper answers. Look, on the one hand, even the American press recognizes that the decision by an American judge to allow vulture funds to benefit without risk from having bought part of Argentina's debt is bad law. And on that respect, one has to be with the government of Argentina. It is a bad decision. It is an unjust decision. And, when it comes to the fact that this is the country that also postulated the Calvo and Drago doctrines, which were precisely going against the use of excessive force in the 19th century by creditors, you can see that they do have something to say about it, and they're right in that respect. On the other hand, all these issues concerning Procter & Gamble, potential tax fraud, this is much less clear. It might be a form of, putting all cats in the same bag and, allowing for some sort of pressure valve. And again, it sounds, I don't think it helps the Kirchner government. It adds to the sense of confusion. Personally, I would love that more governments on this planet of ours went after big corporate tax fraud. This is not necessarily best or most unique example of that. If anything, Argentinians are famous for most Latin Americans, for dodging taxes. So I'm the first one to say that us Latin Americans should pay more taxes, and I'm ready to do so. But this particular instance is not as clear cut. And I would rather distinguish these two sides of the issue. On the one hand, the Argentinians are right on complaining against what is an abuse of justice, of the justice system, in this case, the American justice system, by vulture funds. On the other hand, to paint this image of the night when all cats are black is not necessarily helpful.
Just brief on this. Is Cristina, what's she playing at here? Is this a bit of kind of, got elections coming? Is she playing politics with it? Is she a bit off the rails? How would you
suspect she's playing politics. I mean, I think it may be no coincidence that she's hitting a major American company at a time when, they are very angry about the decision that Oscar is talking about. And actually, it's left them in a difficulty of getting investment in for, she's been being nice to Mr. Putin, being nice to anyone really who can help them out of the problem that they have if they're locked out of international credit. So there's a lot to be angry about. Cristina herself went into hospital with a fever today, so who knows?
One final thought. We're almost out of time, Oscar. I wanted to ask you briefly about, we mentioned Evo Morales and Bolivia's relatively robust performance. He is spending quite a lot of money, it seems, on a very ambitious presidential palace, a 1,000-seat auditorium. It's been inspired by indigenous ceremonies, we understand. Is this money well spent?
Look, I've seen the model. It reminds me of Senate House here in London, more than indigenous architecture. But I dislike even more the current presidential palace, which smacks of old colonialism. And it's actually just a damn ugly building. So I'm, I'm very happy for them to tear it out and replace it with something. It does, these symbols in Bolivia are more than symbols. They do help. You do need spaces for gathering. And since gathering is the trademark of the Bolivian movement, then why not?
And it's only about 10% of what Erdogan is spending in Turkey. So
correct.
Maybe it's a bargain. Make it energy efficient.
thanks very much indeed to both of you for joining us here on Midori House. That's Isabel Hilton and Oscar Guardiola Rivera.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still to come. In the second half of today's Midori House, we'll be continuing that discussion on presidential palaces as our correspondent Joseph Dana weighs in on that new edition in Turkey. Before all of that, though, let's get the latest world news headlines from Paul Osborne.
The African Union has given the military in Burkina Faso 2 weeks to hand power to a civilian transitional government. The military stepped in last week when the country's long-serving president, Blaise Compaoré, was forced from office after violent protests. Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida, who is leading the current government, has already promised to hand power to civilians. In Pakistan, officials say they reinstated a ceremony at the border crossing with India to show the country was united against terrorism. It had been cancelled after a suicide attack on Sunday killed 55 people. At least 23 people are now known to have died in a suicide bomb attack in the northeast of Nigeria. Militants targeted a procession of Shia Muslims in Yobe State, the territory at the heart of Boko Haram's insurgency. And Malaysia has said it wants to turn the wreckage of the passenger jet that crashed in eastern Ukraine into a permanent memorial to the disaster's victims. 298 people died when flight MH17 came down in July. It's thought to have been hit by a surface-to-air missile. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
You are listening to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. We are ticking towards 1900 hours here in London. That's ticking towards 2100 in Istanbul. And that is where we are off to now to speak with one of our many correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Istanbul to catch up with our bureau chief there, Joseph Dana. Joseph, great to speak with you as always. I hope Istanbul is treating you well. Let's start by looking at, how things are treating the populace at large, because I gather there's a new poll which tells us something about how Turks look at the region and at the USA.
Indeed, this new poll that was conducted by the Pew Research Center came out this morning, and it really kind of was awash in all of the daily papers here. And what it really came to the conclusion of was that Turks actually don't really like anyone. So this poll found that there was unfavorable views for a myriad of actors, including the EU, China, Russia, Iran, and of course Israel, who came in as the most unfavorable country in the eyes of the Turkish Republic, or at least the Turkish citizenry. And this really confirms a lot of, let's say, growing patterns in Turkish society. The president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has really tried to forge a kind of go-it-alone sort of strategy, especially in reference to what's going on in Syria and Iraq with the ISIS militants there. This kind of understanding that that Turkey is this isolated, almost superpower or regional power, has really kind of entrenched itself in this societal mindset. And we see these incredibly unfavorable views of all of these actors, including, like I said, Israel and Saudi Arabia. And something like 70% of those polled said that they don't like NATO very much. So it's a pretty significant barometer of where the Turkish citizenry really is when it comes to certain international dynamics.
And Joseph, tell me, because I gather this polling began back in sort of 2002, and it's never really reflected anything other than a fairly unfavorable view of the US. Is this as bad as it's ever been, or were there occasional spikes when, you know, the US was even more unpopular?
Well, of course, the U.S. has never really been that popular in Turkey, despite the real entrenchment of the relationship, the kind of cozy relationship between the Turkish government and the U.S. government, especially when it comes to, you know, military aid coming from the United States to Turkey. But as you said, this is a relationship that has never been really that great, and we're really seeing a big spike now, specifically because of the U.S.-led coalition against ISIS in northern Syria and Iraq, and that real friction that we've been talking about over the last month in terms of whether or not Turkey is going to take a forward position, at least a forward position in how the coalition partners would like to see them take in this fight against ISIS, as well as this myriad of other actors on the ground in northern Syria. And I think that it's only sadly going to get worse, despite the fact that if you walk around the streets of Istanbul, you see an incredible amount of American tourists. Americans as themselves in the city specifically are very welcome, you know, kind of players, and Turkish Airlines is expanding all across the United States. And so on this political level, we see a real disjointed kind of message coming across. But on the very basic societal level, on the tourism level, Turkey is still very welcoming towards Americans.
Now, you mentioned Erdogan a little earlier, Joseph, and in fact, earlier in this program, we were talking about Bolivia and sort of presidential palace building. Tell us a little bit about this presidential complex for Erdogan then, because this is getting him a lot of column inches, I imagine some of which he probably wouldn't welcome.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, I've got the International New York Times in front of me from the weekend, and above the fold, there is a massive photo of this new palace in Ankara, which is said to be larger than the White House and the Kremlin. We are talking about a complex beyond imagination for a political leader in this part of the world. It costs something like $350 million. It has 1,000 rooms, an underground tunnel system, and the latest in anti-espionage technology, which is going to be very important. important because of all of these corruption probes that have been really taking over the Turkish political spectrum of the last year. And it is not a very favorable article in the New York Times, and that's perhaps one of the reasons why this Pew poll about Turkish understandings of the rest of the world is so reflective, because it's very much going after let's say Erdogan's grand ambitions, and it details the fact that this palace really embodies a lot of the criticism that Erdogan has come under over the last year, and it's placed on an environmental reserve, which, you know, apparently there was a very serious environmental impact because of building this, and Erdogan kind of just looked aside, and it's part of a number of other initiatives that Erdogan has made for himself to be the new president, one of which is a new $200 million fleet, basically a presidential fleet, which he began earmarking money for about 3 years ago. And so we see a certain foresight from the Erdogan administration, as it were, that he really intended to be in the office of president by this time. And additionally, it was originally intended to be the prime minister's actual complex. And so it's another kind of sore spot in terms of how Erdogan is maneuvering his power. You know, he used to be the prime minister. The prime minister officially in Turkey is supposed to answer to no one. And the president's actually second in line. And he has engineered this kind of Putin-esque shift to become president and shift the kind of structures of powers here. And really, this new palace that we're talking about has come to embody all of these trends in Erdogan's very long-standing and illustrative kind of political career in this country.
Joseph, I imagine there's been quite a lot of interesting coverage about this, you know, as you say, all around the world. What's the sort of coverage, I guess, when we look at Turkey in foreign policy terms at the moment then? Do you think, because we've talked a little bit before about NATO membership and the impact that that's had, how do you characterize the situation presently?
I've always found this to be a very interesting ongoing debate in Turkey. You know, Turkey is a very, very important member of the NATO alliance. It's been a very important member of the NATO alliance for 62 years. This is an alliance that has been mutually beneficial for all parties. It's kind of firmly placed Turkey in this Western bloc, as well as allowing NATO to be, you know, to kind of have a stick in the sand, as it were, in this very volatile part of the world. But we've seen over the last month in this heightened debate about the ISIS situation in northern Syria and Iraq, this debate about whether or not Turkey should be in NATO. Now, in the pro-government press in this country, in Turkey, there's been a lot of debate about what you know, kind of Turkey gets out of this NATO membership. Some people, very hardline people, believe that NATO is in fact shackling Turkish foreign policy to do what it deems necessary, especially in Syria. And on the other side of the row, as it were, we see a lot of specifically American conservatives flirting with this idea that it's time to kick Turkey out of NATO. Now, I don't think we're going to see Turkey being kicked out of NATO anytime soon, but we do see this real sticking point in terms of how Turkey interacts with the West. And I think this is only going to continue as there's more disagreements about what to do in Syria, specifically with ISIS. And so this is a debate that's not going to go away. But in my estimation, I really see it unlikely that Turkey will be either kicked out of NATO or will voluntarily leave the alliance in some sort of way.
From our bureau in Istanbul, that's Monocle's Joseph Dana. Joseph, great to speak with you as always. We'll catch up again soon, I'm sure. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll go to a civics class in Pakistan that's using Western philosophers to inspire its students. Stay tuned.
Spirit, love, energy, and culture. To be quickly accessible, unreroute the river, let the dammed water be. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, 1843, here in London. Now, students in Islamabad are expanding their reading lists, and it's prompting change. The organisation Generation Citizen have just finished running a civics class that asked teens to read Plato and other Western philosophers, then look at niche regional issues that affect them. The project already has Pakistani officials making small reforms. Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli spoke with Samir Butt, creator of the programme, a little earlier. He began by asking her to explain exactly how the class works.
This class is actually an attempt to teach Pakistani citizens or Pakistani youth about citizenship. So what we try to teach students is the skills that we think are necessary for them to be effective and engaged citizens in Pakistan today. To us, that means academic skills and practical skills both. So we try to teach them critical thinking, reading and writing skills, or try to really enhance them because, you know, everybody already has critical thinking, reading and writing skills. And we also try to teach them, more importantly, about, you know, the practical skills that they need to be engaged citizens. So learning about the resources that they have at hand in their communities to solve problems.
I mean, some of the texts that you're teaching, I mean, I'm looking at them now. I mean, some of them are pretty, you know, pretty far out there in terms of controversy. I mean, Foucault, Discipline and Punish. I mean, that's a fairly weighty, controversial text.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it is for a lot of people, but for most students and teachers here, it's just like another really interesting text to read. I think that they thought it was gripping. A lot of them did. I don't know that they necessarily registered it as controversial, I guess. But also, a lot of people see this as just a way to read books and talk about, you know, government and democracy, which is such a big thing in Pakistan these days. For anyone who knows or who's kind of aware of what's going on these days, there's this huge political rally that's been happening since August, and basically people are, you know, going all around the country protesting against the current government's alleged involvement in electoral fraud and demanding the prime minister's resignation. And it's raising all sorts of great questions about what democracy is and what government is and what citizenship should look like. So this is kind of, even though it's been a couple of years in the making and we've been doing it for the past few summers, this is kind of fitting into that conversation. So it isn't really controversial. I think it kind of fits the mood at the moment.
Can you tell me how the average Pakistani student kind of views citizenship? I mean, of course, around the world, people view it differently. In the U.S., it's, you know, it could be very state-based, but also there's supreme kind of national pride, too. In the U.K., it's a bit different. I mean, do Pakistani students in Islamabad, do they identify more with their city or more with kind of the country itself?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I would think that patriotism plays a huge role in kids' conception of citizenship. I know that increasingly, over the past few years, people have started to associate it with responsibilities and rights as a person belonging to a state or to a country. But I think a large part of it for most people definitely has to do with their sense of pride and belonging to this place. I think it definitely ties more into that. It's interesting because for most Pakistanis that I know, regardless of where they are across the world or what they're studying, if you look at their Facebook profiles or their Twitter pictures, a lot of their pictures will be of the Pakistani flag, or it'll be of like truck art or symbols that represent things that we are typically proud of as Pakistani people, which I think speaks volumes to what, you know, their primary association is in terms of identity, at least.
And finally, tell me about the project in which the students are trying to kind of convince the federal government to have training for religious minorities.
Yeah. So, like I mentioned in the beginning, part of this class is about teaching students about how to use resources in their community to solve problems around them. And the project that the kids were working on had to do with religious rifts in our communities. So the way that they went about it was, and the way that we teach students, is that you identify a problem around you, you look for a root cause, and then try to address one of the root causes that is causing the problem and develop an action plan to mitigate the problem. And so the students picked religious rifts in their community, and they thought about it for a while, and they decided that one of the main causes for religious rifts is that teachers in all schools, basically, aren't equipped to train or to deal with these situations and to deal with minority students well. And so they basically found the decision maker or the influential person in this case who was responsible for public schools in Islamabad. And they found out that it was the Federal Directorate of Education and the Director of Training at that institute. And so they had a series of meetings with the Director of Education there, the Director of Trainings there, and they had meetings with the staff, and they had meetings with other organizations in Islamabad, and they realized that there are lots of people who are very willing to train teachers in Islamabad about human rights issues and about religious minorities and how to properly deal with minority issues, and that the only thing that they had to do was connect them to decision makers, in this case, the director of trainings at the Federal Director of Education. So they wrote a proposal to him to basically allow them to set up that initial meeting where they would link the resources to the director to work together to provide these trainings to school teachers. So it's not really trying to solve the entire problem of religious rifts in Pakistan or even in Islamabad. That's just trying to contribute a little bit to address one of the root causes in the city.
That was Samia Butt with Generation Citizen in Islamabad, speaking with Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're ticking towards the top of the hour. It'll soon be 1900 hours in London, but there's time left before the end of the show to catch up with our daily arts review. Today we talk to Shanna Beth Mason, a contemporary art critic in New York, and she joins us now from our New York Bureau. Shanna, great to speak with you. Thanks for joining us as ever on Midori House. I wanted to ask you first of all about interesting piece, really, looking at Britain's standing in the international art market. Anyone who was at Frieze in the last couple of weeks would think everything was in robust health, but apparently things are maybe not what they seem.
I would agree with that. I was at Frieze. I had the pleasure of being at Frieze several weeks back, and I would definitely agree with that. I think that things are seldom what they seem, especially in terms of the market. And this piece by James Pickford in the Financial Times stating that now British artists and, you know, the British art market is suffering under the weight of the New York influence. I might agree with that, and yet I don't tend to follow as closely with the market behaviors as I do with artists and you know, sort of soft influence. So this was a bit of a surprise to me to read.
What do you think is behind it then? Looking at those kind of softer issues, are there shifting sands that are at play here? Or do you think it is just a kind of, it's a real art market story, and maybe people who are really interested in the art itself maybe won't be too preoccupied?
I think I would probably slate myself into that group, because I tend to not focus on numbers, or I tend to not focus on the transactive element of these types of stories. A lot of critics do, and a lot of other analysts do, and that is, you know, a part of it. But for myself, I worry more for the artists that don't get mentioned in this bracket, the artists that don't show at Frieze, the artists that don't show at Art Basel, at all of the major art fairs or any institutions for that matter, because they get left out of this conversation entirely, regardless of the way the market shifts or tanks or whatever it does.
Mm. Intriguing stuff. Let's talk a little bit, Shanna, about some other stories and things that you've picked up for us to look at. What about ghost stories in London? Tell me more.
Yeah, I had noticed that there's a very provocative trend, at least during and around Frieze, for shows and exhibitions that seem to highlight some sort of ghostly presence or commentary on the afterlife. Steve McQueen's film Ashes deals with a beautiful young black boy that was filmed in Grenada in the West Indies, and it was reclaimed footage from Robbie Mueller, who worked with him on Carib's Leap, which was a film that he had also previously worked on, and it is a tribute to a boy who was murdered. And then at Maureen Paley, she presented a film by Gillian Waring called We Are Here, which was a take on Spooner's, the American author Spooner, about how people would basically talk from the grave and discuss their regrets and their memories and their misgivings. Same thing at Matt's Gallery in the East End as well. Revolver 2 was a show that literally took place within the gallery archives. You put on a set of binaural headphones that canceled all noise around you, and you were literally being plunged into what was a secretly recorded seance. So there seems to be this, you know, incredible trend of ghostly or, you know, phantom-like presences in these shows. And I loved it.
It sounds absolutely terrifying. I just wonder, though, it's interesting, isn't it, Shannon? I mean, it's always been an area that's proved very fertile ground for sort of artistic exploration, hasn't it? You know, the afterlife. Mm. There's so much about that. Do you think it's going to always be a compelling area for contemporary artists to operate within? Because, it's inspired their predecessors through all the ages, practically.
You could go back to the earliest forms of human expression to talk about what could come after death, and that was communicated in cave paintings, what happened when animals died. So, and certainly throughout the Middle Ages, the proliferation of religious art, you feared for your soul. The same thing, I think, as long as we believe as viewers, as an audience, that there may or may not be some sort of alternate world, some sort of wait and see what happens, we'll always have questions, we'll always have answers, or what we believe to be answers.
Exactly.
In the form of visual production.
Lovely stuff. Let's talk a little bit, because we're a bit short of time, Shannon, about some emerging artists. You've got some sort of picks for us, things you've seen around and about. Tell us who we should be looking out for.
Well, there's three artists that I want to go over quickly. The first is someone I had the pleasure of having a lovely studio visit with in London. His name is Alessandro Roma. He was born in Milan, and he's based in his East End studio in London, and he will be showing at the Sobering Gallery in Paris with a solo show early next year in several months' time. And his work really just employs such beautiful, floral and herbal imagery in these overlaid patterns of curtains, of canvases, and they make no excuses for the fact that they are just lovely and delicate to look at. And on that note, the second artist I had recommended in terms of watching is Aramis Gutierrez, and he's based down in Miami. He's one third of an artist run gallery called Gucci Vuitton, that's one word, and his work is actually represented in Miami by Spinello Projects, and he has a beautiful body of work that shows male ballet dancers, including Nureyev, Baryshnikov, and the empty spaces, the active spaces that happen in ballet rehearsal rooms. And the final artist I'd love to mention is based right here in New York. His studio is in the Gowanus area of Brooklyn. His name is Saul Melman. And not only is he a professional artist, but he's actually a professional doctor as well. And so he's coordinated this medical practice and knowledge of medicine into every aspect of his visual production. But the latest that he's done is create a series of photographs that were taken via Camera Oscura in Joshua Tree in California. And he spent some time out there putting pinholes in these huge shipping containers and using them as dark rooms to, capture live performances in the desert.
It sounds absolutely arresting, Shannon. I wonder, it's always a tricky question, but do you have a favourite of your three picks? I love the idea of the sort of artist book you're mentioning, Alessandro Roma's work, using paper, as medium and material. Did you have a favourite?
Oh, that's not fair. That's like asking to choose between your children. No, I genuinely think, and, it, it just so happens that they happen to be male artists. There's so many female painters and sculptors out there that I'm looking at as well. I mean, it just there's no boundary to the amount of creativity that's out there, and that's why I'm just constantly starstruck by what these artists can create. The fact that they have so many new dialogues to contribute. Honestly, I don't, you know, I just visited Saul's studio recently. I was in Alessandro's studio last week. I've known Aramis for 4 years, so.
Don't worry, Shannon. We won't make you choose. It was an excellent roundup. It's a three-way tie. That's good stuff. Monocle's contributor in New York City, Shannon Beth Mason. Thanks so much for stopping by our bureau there to join us on Midori House. Thanks to my guests today, especially Isabel Hilton and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Thanks to our producer Emily Elias and our researcher David Pleasant and our studio manager Chris Chilvers. Culture's next. This show's back at the same time tomorrow. From me, Tom Edwards, for today, it's goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.